A warm welcome to our radio audience from the Midcoast Forum in Maine. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum, which was founded in 1983 by a small group of retirees living in the Midcoast of Maine with an interest in foreign policy. Our current membership of about 160 includes former diplomats, international businessmen, retired academics, and others with an interest in foreign affairs. For further information, please see our website at www.midcoastforum.org. We have a monthly meeting, almost always on a Monday, at the coastal resort of Point Lookout between Camden and Belfast to hear an informed speaker discuss a topic of international interest. Today, we are very lucky to have Professor Marvin Ott. He's currently the visiting professor at Johns Hopkins University and public policy scholar at Woodrow Wilson International Center. An expert on Asia, he got his master's and his doctorate from the School of the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. Earlier, he was a professor of national security policy at the National War College, and before going into academia, he had been the senior manager at the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment, senior East Asia analyst at the CIA, senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and to start off his career in Asia, he was the deputy province rep in Ban Mathuot in the highlands of central South Vietnam in 1965. He has traveled and worked widely in Asia and is the author of more than 100 chapters, articles, monographs, and all sorts of articles about international affairs, primarily East Asian intelligence and technology-related topics. His topic today, the strategic arena no one knows, China and Southeast Asia. Marvin.
Thank you. A couple preliminary comments. It was a very nice introduction. It left out perhaps the most important thing. For a number of years now, I've written a biweekly column for the Ellsworth American, published in Ellsworth, Maine. So that's for our purposes today, that's probably my principal calling card. Also, I might mention that sort of New England roots, I taught at Mount Holyoke College for a number of years, very early on. And then a lot of my career has been in and around the intelligence world, and I was deputy staff director of the Senate Intelligence Committee for a period prior to joining the National War College. So I come to you as somebody who sort of kicked around the government in a variety of capacities and then been outside the government for part of my career. I am not a sinologist. I'm somebody who's watched China, though, for a long time. And as was mentioned, I actually attended a Chinese school back in my sophomore years. So whatever assets I bring to this enterprise will tend to come from a kind of diverse and broad background. I should also add that this will go down in memory as the Midcoast Forum when the speaker forgot his notes. I managed to leave this morning and left my travel bag because I was going to pick it up afterwards, and all my notes are in the travel bag. So we're going to wing it here, and there's going to be a fair amount of improvisation. But my guess is that the most interesting and valuable part of this will be the interchange that will come in a Q&A. So I'll lean heavily on that. But let me, with that sort of apology in advance, make it just a couple of quick preliminary comments. The topic that I've tried to pose for you is the relationship between China and Southeast Asia. And I would have, and sort of the teaser in it, I think you can argue persuasively that until very recently, and by very recently I mean specifically July of last year, the relationship between China, Southeast Asia, China's strategy towards Southeast Asia, China's policies and activities in that part of the world was essentially unattended, unknown, outside the purview or the area of interest of virtually anybody, including those in government. And I operate and live in Washington, D.C. most of the time, and I've been beating the drum for you got to start to pay attention to what China's doing in Southeast Asia around the Defense Department, the CIA, the State Department, and so on for lo these many years, and essentially it's a voice in the wilderness. Yes, that's very interesting. Come and talk to us about it, but now let's move on to something more important. That's beginning to change. And so we're looking at a subject that is now beginning to get some traction, and I will make a prediction for you that over in about 3 or 4 years from now, when anybody says Southeast Asia, for most people that are sort of attend to public affairs and are paying attention, as soon as you say Southeast Asia, that's immediately going to mean an association with China. That China is going to be the subject. You know, it's going to be China all day, every day, 24 hours a day when it comes to Southeast Asia. And that's what we're going to start to focus on. And it's going to be increasingly a focus of U.S. security strategy. And if you talk to the current commander of Pacific Forces in Honolulu with responsibility for the Pacific area, the Pacific commander, U.S. Forces, he already has no doubt that the future of U.S. strategy and U.S. military concern is going to be here. So it's part of my sort of promo for the subject. I should also add that I think it's worth saying that I bring to this a particular optic. I was trained, and lots of people are trained very differently. I was trained in a geopolitical, realpolitik way of understanding international affairs. That is a European tradition of understanding how international politics works. It tends to focus heavily on national interest. Sort of the first question you ask about a country, in this case China, what is their national interest? How do they define it? How do they see it? And then what capacity, i.e. power, do they have to implement that interest, to affect it as they understand it? There are many other ways of understanding international affairs, but that's the optic I bring to it. And I mention that because I think that perspective works in East Asia. East Asia, at the senior levels of government, is chock-a-block with students of realpolitik. You find them in New Delhi, you find them in Singapore, you find them in Hanoi, you find them in Seoul, and you certainly find them in Beijing. This is the way the Chinese view East Asia. It is classic realpolitik, and the Chinese are intimately interested in power and how power is distributed and where they fit into the power structure and what the dynamics of power are, and they see the U.S. largely in terms not of U.S. ideology and freedom and all the things that we tend to think about. They see the U.S. in terms of the power that we have and what capacities, what are its limitations, what's happening to defense budgets, what does it mean, what does it mean for China, China versus the U.S., all the rest of it. Okay, so let me make that kind of my prologue, but also maybe sort of part of a prologue. I see the subject of China and Southeast Asia as embedded in and part of a larger phenomenon in East Asia, and that is the rise of Asia generally. We are seeing, many of you will recall, going through airports in the 80s, seeing the title, something about the Pacific Century, and sort of variations on that theme, that sort of Asia is the coming thing. That was probably a bit premature in the 1980s, but it's not premature anymore. We are, in fact, into the Pacific Century. What we are witnessing in the sort of the sweep of history is the growth of economic capacity in East Asia, starting first of all with Japan pre-war, but then spreading post-war into the Sinicized cultures of East Asia, Korea, Taiwan, into the Sinicized urban centers of Southeast Asia, a modernization of economies that puts these societies on a growth track that allows them to start to join the established industrialized and post-industrialized countries of the West. The World Bank in 1993 published a major study which they called the Asian Miracle. And the question, in effect, that the bank was posing was, and they focused on Southeast Asia, they said, how is it that an area like Southeast Asia, 10 countries, roughly the same sort of size, geographically, population, and so on, with comparable areas like in Central America, like in West Africa, and if you looked at those three areas in the 1950s, sort of in the immediate post-colonial period, all of them look pretty comparable. Standards of living, levels of education, colonial experience, you know, all basically on roughly the same plane. And yet, in 1993, when we do this study at the World Bank, they're not on the same plane at all. The countries of Southeast Asia have far exceeded the countries of Central America and West Africa in a process of modernization. And so the World Bank, basically, what's the secret in Southeast Asia that can be then, hopefully, lessons learned that can be replicated elsewhere? That's a sort of sidebar, and I won't go down that track unless anyone is particularly interested in what the World Bank had to say about it. But I will note that I see Southeast Asia as embedded in this broader phenomenon of the rise of Asia, and we've seen the rise of Asia then extend to China, which will be the focus here, and more recently to India. And essentially, what we're seeing is the Asians are figuring out, have figured out, how the West did it. How was it that a bunch of sort of small, sort of scruffy little countries in Northern Europe in the 16, 17, and 1800s ended up ruling the world? You know, why wasn't it Iran or some of the great civilizations of elsewhere in the world? How was it that England and Germany and the Netherlands and places like that, that had almost nothing going for them, ended up astride the planet? And we can sort of talk about what the secret was. I'd be happy to play with it. It's the sort of thing you can spend a lifetime studying, obviously. But my argument is basically the Asians, unlike most of Africa, unlike most of the Middle East, unlike even large parts of Latin America, the Asians have really figured out how the West did it. And they not only have figured out how we did it, they basically have said, we can do it even better. We can improve. You know, Toyota is a better motor car company than General Motors is, sort of circa early 1990s. We can do it even better than you do it. So that's the broader phenomenon, I think, that's been occurring. And at the heart of it, of course, lies China. It's worth remembering that China, for most of the period since, or for much of the period since the communists took over in 1949, has been a mess. Mao Zedong led the Chinese Revolution. He was a highly radicalized, highly ideologically driven national leader who was consumed by the notion of revolution. Amongst his legacy for China was the so-called Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution that lasted from the mid-60s to the mid-70s. It tore China apart. It created a sort of artificial social civil war inside of China. The Chinese today refer to it as the 10 lost years or the lost decade. Your senior leadership in China went through that experience. They were seared by it. China basically, during that period, shut down its foreign relations entirely. There was only one Chinese ambassador left overseas at the height of the Proletarian Cultural Revolution. I mean, China had myriad self-inflicted wounds during the period up to roughly 1980. But when Mao dies and you go through this tumultuous transition period of the Gang of Four and Madame Mao and all of that, you end up, when the dust settles, a little guy about this tall, sort of hunched over, named Deng Xiaoping, who had been a Long March veteran with Mao Zedong, was part of the inner circle, had been victimized in the Cultural Revolution, but he's tough as nails and he figured out a way to survive it. His son at one point got tossed out of the second floor window by Red Guards. He's been paralegic ever since. So Deng Xiaoping had experienced this thing, but he comes to power and he makes it clear that he's going to change China's trajectory radically and totally. And there are these wonderful aphorisms. Deng says, amongst other things, he says, "I don't care if the cat is black or white. All I care is whether it catches mice." By that he means, I don't give, pardon the term, a rat's ass about the ideology. I'm looking for results. And by results, he meant economic performance, you know, the growth of China as a going concern. Deng Xiaoping was a nationalist in the generic sense, devoted to the strength and future of China, and that was a lot more important than the Maoist ideology. He also had another wonderful aphorism. He says, to get rich is glorious. Now, this is against the backdrop of the Cultural Revolution, which was radically egalitarian. Everybody was supposed to, getting rich was a death sentence. Now the paramount leader says, to get rich is glorious. And so China then launches on a trajectory of economic growth, basically to join the rise of Asia. And the results have been spectacular. We're looking at, it's very hard, you know, these numbers get a little soft, but we're looking at accumulated per capita annual GDP growth since 1979 in China of somewhere around 9.5% per year. Now, you know, you can do the arithmetic in terms of doubling time, but your GDP, your aggregate strength of your economy, the size of your economy, is growing like a rocket when you're growing at 9.5%. You know, if we manage 2.5%, we think we're growing very fast. Europeans manage 1.5%; they think they're doing pretty well. So the result is we're seeing a transformation of China on a scale that has no precedent in human history. Nothing like it has ever happened before. And it will, to borrow an old Napoleonic phrase, it will shake the world. And it is shaking the world. And as part of the rise of Chinese, with the rise of the economy, becomes national power. The foundation stone of national power is the economy. And the Chinese have made the translation very directly. They have invested in their military at a pace that even exceeds the growth of the aggregate economy. So the published Chinese numbers have had numbers like annual increases in per capita defense spending of 17% per year, 17 aggregate each year increase. Well, numbers like that do dramatic things to your military capacity unless you're just completely squandering it. And the Chinese have not squandered it. So we're seeing fundamentally, you know, late in the game on the rise of Asia, we're seeing now the growth of Chinese power as the central fact, geopolitically, back to my geopolitics, of Asia. This coincides with two related things, just worth noting before we move on. One, I use the word nationalism. As China's economic transformation has taken hold, is striking the degree to which the ideology that was so consuming in China, Maoism, Marxist-Leninism, communism, all of that, has essentially been discarded. You still have a nominal adherence to the ideology. You still have a party school. You still have a Politburo and all of that. But in terms of real belief in the ideology, somebody has commented there are more true communists in Cambridge, Massachusetts than there are in China. And that's That's probably about right. So the ideology has lost its content. Now, that's a problem because you have a self-appointed elite. You know, you're a Chinese citizen, you're watching TV, and here's the National Party Congress, and there are 17 guys sitting up there in blue suits on the dais, and they're running China. Well, who gave those guys the right to run China? I don't remember ever electing them. I mean, who are these guys? Where, you know, well, they're the Politburo, Standing Committee of the Politburo of the Communist Party of China. That's what gives them the right. What do you mean the communist, you know, nobody takes communism seriously anymore. What is this? So it's a problem if you're part of the Chinese leadership, is to borrow the political science term, how do you legitimate the regime if the ideology no longer has any real currency? And the answer is basically twofold. One, you legitimate the regime by, I don't know, was it Herbert Hoover or Calvin Coolidge had the electoral slogan, a car in every garage and a chicken in every pot. It's essentially, we deliver the goods. We, the Chinese Politburo, the senior leadership, are providing 9.5% per annum annual growth. It's maldistributed and all that. Nevertheless, aggregately, the life of Chinese, of the Chinese citizenry is getting better. And that gives us the right to have power because we are performing in economic terms. And the other thing we're delivering, we these guys in the blue suits, we are delivering power. We are restoring China's place at the center of the world, the Middle Kingdom. Keep in mind, very long tradition that sees China as the only, by long, I mean, I'm talking in Chinese terms, 4,000 to 5,000 years of continuous civilization, the only true civilization on the planet. All other peoples outside of China, the non-Han, are to some degree barbarians. They're not truly civilized because they're not Chinese. And but to be civilized is to be, by definition, Chinese. If you're very close to China and you partake of a lot of Chinese culture, like the Vietnamese, then you're a very civilized, relatively speaking, barbarian. If you're further afield, if you're on Java or in Malaya, well, you're so far beyond the glow of civilization that you're in a truly barbaric state. And if the Chinese traditionally had even known that North America existed, you can imagine what they would have thought of the folks that lived there. So the sense of China's primacy and centrality is, I would argue, deeply embedded. It's in the DNA. It's in the marrow of the bones. And what the Chinese leadership is doing is they're saying to the Chinese populace, not only are we putting a chicken in every pot in the car in every garage, but we're also restoring China's power, influence, and prestige. China is resuming its place at the head of the table, under the sun, whatever metaphor you want to use, where China rightfully should be. And it's worth keeping in mind that if you're Chinese, you're acutely aware that the world's greatest civilization, the world's only true civilization, the proudest people on the planet, have gone through 200 years of utter humiliation. And this goes back to the Opium Wars, the treaty ports, the semi-colonization of China by the Europeans, that whole period. And then, worst of all, comes the 1930s and 1940s when the Japanese invade and occupy China. And it's worth noting that a traditional phrase that the Chinese have used, this is going back decades and, you know, maybe centuries, I don't know, to refer to the Japanese translates as our dwarf slaves in the East. Now, you know, it's an expression of total contempt. And if that's the sort of popular sort of notion of the Japanese, now the dwarf slaves in the East have occupied China. You have the Nanjing Massacre. You have, this awful history of the 30s and 40s. And for the Chinese, there can be no greater humiliation than to have been occupied and despoiled by Japan. So when Mao Zedong comes to power in China in 1949, in his first statement to the Chinese people, as his armies have come into Beijing, he goes into the Forbidden City, to the Tiananmen Square, goes up onto the balcony, the Gate of Heavenly Peace, and his first words are not the workers of the world have united or the communist revolution has succeeded or anything like that. The first words are China has stood up. It is a statement of national pride. And I would argue that is absolutely animating today for the Chinese leadership. Okay, focusing on Southeast Asia, and maybe somebody can give me a sort of like hold up 5 minutes when I'm about out of time. I'll try and sort of do 12, 13 minutes here and wrap things up. But focus specifically on Southeast Asia. My essential argument to you is against this backdrop of Chinese pride, growing power, and a willingness to assert that power, that the focus of all of that is not where most people have tended to kind of assume it without thinking, like it's going to be somehow Japan, Korea, Northeast Asia. No, it's not. Northeast Asia for the Chinese is a rough, tough neighborhood. Koreans and Japanese, basically it's a place where the Chinese want to prevent bad things from happening, like a North Korean nuclear program out of control, or it's the Japanese decision to go nuclear, or a collapse of North Korea and tens of thousands of starving North Koreans coming into Manchuria. Northeast Asia is a place where you basically try to contain bad outcomes. Where your opportunity lies as a Chinese, your strategic, where you can make your strategic money, as it were, proverbial, you know, sort of metaphorically and real, is to the south. The south in Southeast Asia is, in the traditional terms in China, translate, one is Nanyang, which means the South Seas. Another translates as the Golden Lands. Southeast Asia, in the Chinese traditional view, is a land of opportunity, of wealth and opportunity. It's kind of where the golden goose lives. There are, from a Chinese standpoint, there are a number of reasons to focus on Southeast Asia. Just to tick them off. Part of it is history, long historical relationship. Many of you will have heard the term tribute system. I don't have time to go into much detail. It's actually not a Chinese term. It was a term coined by American sinologist John K. Fairbank at Harvard to describe a relationship. And essentially what it boiled down to was you're a potentate in northern Burma, you know, some minor king. You're close to China, and the Chinese dynasties and empires are sort of waxing and waning, and now you're in a period when the Chinese empire is in a growth phase. It behooves you, as just politic and smart, to descend a mission to the imperial throne in wherever the imperial throne happens to be, the dragon throne, bringing gifts to the emperor as an expression of subordination and respect. And you will go and you will have your appointed time and you will appear before the emperor and you'll do the kowtows and all the expressions of deference that are required, and you will present your gifts. And the emperor will graciously receive you and he will load you down with gifts in return. Now, actually, it'll probably work very well for the potentate in Burma, because he'll probably, what he gets back is worth more than what he delivered. But that's not the point. The point is this is symbolism and ceremony. This is an expression, think in terms of a kind of Confucian order. This is an expression of the subordinate member of the family, of respect and deference to the head of the family. And the head of the family then receives, appreciates that, and feels an obligation to protect and enable the subordinate. So it is a... You know, from a Western standpoint, it's a sort of, what's the point? I mean, if you want to do something in Burma, go in and occupy the place, make it a colony, put in your, you know, establish a commercial relationship, make money off of it. I mean, that's what you do if you're an empire, right? The Chinese view was traditionally very different. It was all about it was all about the psychological dimension of superiority and inferiority. Okay, so you have that long historical tradition. You also have geography. Southeast Asia is next door, long shared boundary, Laos, Vietnam, Burma, and so on. You also have ethnicity. You've got large numbers of ethnic Chinese resident in Southeast Asia. And that's basically a product of the Western colonial period, and we can talk about that if you'd like to. But suffice it to say, you end up, as the colonists leave, you end up with a residue of prominent, economically successful Chinese in urban centers throughout Southeast Asia. So if I'm a Chinese strategist looking at Southeast Asia, what I'm seeing are my fellow ethnic countrymen all over the region in positions of real influence and provide real strategic opportunity. Okay, so for the list can go on, but so for a variety of reasons, Southeast Asia, from the point of view of a Chinese strategist, is opportunity and it is vulnerability. If Northeast Asia is a tough neighborhood, Southeast Asia is a soft neighborhood. I've been told by Singaporean diplomats that their counterparts, they talk to all the time in China, actually use the phrase coined by Winston Churchill, the soft underbelly. Churchill was using it to refer to the Mediterranean during World War II. The Chinese use it to refer to Southeast Asia as the soft underbelly. So for the Chinese, Southeast Asia, for a growing, strategically ambitious China, restoring its place is economic opportunity, is strategic opportunity. Now, what has China done to implement that strategy? Again, lots can be said on all these points. I'll just tick off some fairly quickly. Probably the place to start is on the diplomatic side. We've seen since the mid-1990s in particular, even before, but particularly since the mid-1990s, a very skilled, very energetic Chinese diplomatic reach in the direction of Southeast Asia, basically to establish presence, to establish influence, but also to establish, for want of a better term, an image for China in the region. And the image that China has purveyed is that Southeast Asia is very fortunate to have China as a neighbor, because China is essentially a rising power, but a benign power. China's principal interests are the stability of the region, economic development. China is engaged in its own economic development. It needs and wants Southeast Asia as an economic partner. It does not want conflict in the region. It needs for its own construction a region of prosperity and stability, and it's basically a message, we'll all get rich together. So China will be a benign neighbor and an economic partner and a major asset to Southeast Asia. So part of this is to convey, the beginning of the strategy is to convey an image of what kind of a power China will be and is. A second part of the strategy relates to Japan, and it is basically to render the Japanese strategically irrelevant in Southeast Asia. There is a deep well of animosity towards Japan in China. I think everybody's aware of that. But as far as Southeast Asia is concerned, what the Chinese see there is a history through the 60s, 70s, and 80s of a very active Japanese commercial trade investment presence in the region, but one that the Japanese have never been able to translate into political and strategic influence. And the Chinese are determined that they're not going to do that. And so the Chinese have been, first of all, gradually displacing Japan as the principal economic partner for Southeast Asia, but they're also have worked successfully to render Japan basically irrelevant, not a voice, not an influence. In strategic terms. Harder problem, the United States, present in the region both commercially, diplomatically, sort of multidimensional, but also militarily. It's the military part that's a problem if you're a Chinese strategist. And the Chinese, I think it's fair to say, are determined to find ways to marginalize and ultimately expel U.S. military power from the region. Why? Because this is China's backyard. This is China's, to use the geopolitical term, natural sphere of influence. I'll cite I don't have time for a lot of anecdotes, but I'll cite just one. I joined the National War College in the early 1990s and got a phone call and said, hey, there's this guy from China, don't know much about him, but he's in Washington and he wants to talk about U.S.-China strategy issues in East Asia. Can you come over and meet with him? And I said, sure. So I did, and there were about two others at the table. So a very small group. And this guy's name was Chen Xiaolu. And first of all, this guy, you know, who is this guy? This is something about him that's pretty interesting, because this was a time when China was very buttoned down. And if Chinese traveled abroad, they traveled in very structured groups, and they had their secret police guy with them to make sure nobody did anything untoward, and the political, you know, handler was there, and all of this was all very tightly bounded. This guy was traveling alone. He had no handler, had no secret police guy. He seemed to have an unlimited budget. He was staying in a 5-star hotel. He seemed to be able to see anybody he wanted, set his own schedule. This guy is really well connected. Well, it turned out he was. His father was a member of the Standing Committee of the Politburo, or former member, had been foreign minister. And a long discussion, and towards the end of it, and the Chinese, to my perception, have a endearing quality that Americans tend to appreciate. Unlike many Asians, they will occasionally tell you exactly what they think, whether you like it or not. And Chen Xiaolu, after a long discussion, said, look, you guys keep asking about Chinese strategy, intentions, perceptions, and so on in East Asia. He says, I will tell you what the Chinese leadership, the Chinese military leadership thinks. Now, this is early 1990s. He said, when the Chinese military leadership look at East Asia, what they see, and the U.S. and all that, what they see is, first of all, the U.S., and he used terminology just about like this. He said, you Americans have got playgrounds all over the world where you can play. You can play in the Atlantic, and you can play in the Caribbean, and you can play in the Indian Ocean, and you can play in the Eastern Pacific and Central Pacific. You got lots of playgrounds. This playground, Southeast Asia, South China Sea, the Western Pacific, this is our playground. You have no business being here. This belongs to us, not to you. And then he went on to say, he says, the Chinese military is determined to build the power to do two things. One, we will to solve Taiwan, special case, solve Taiwan militarily if we have to. And secondly, to push U.S. military power out of Southeast Asia, South China Sea, Western Pacific. Now, I thought that was one of these moments when, you listen to lots of things that are sort of being said for effect and sort of by the book and so on. Once in a while, sort of like the Wizard of Oz, the curtain parts, and you actually see the wizard. Well, this was a moment when the curtain parted, and it was, thank you very much. That was the real thing. That was how we really think. And to my mind, I have seen nothing since Chen Xiaolu had that little conversation to change my view that was an authentic understanding of how the Chinese military leadership think. Now, he didn't, as I recall it, purport to speak for the foreign ministry or the party, but he was speaking for the military. And the military is an increasingly potent voice, some would even argue a dominant voice in Chinese strategy today. Okay, let me sort of wind up what are the Chinese doing about their strategy? Just one last thing to note it, and then move on to South China Sea, and I'll wind up with that. All of this adds up to, as far as Southeast Asia is concerned, a Chinese strategic determination to render Southeast Asia compliant and subordinate to Chinese interests. That doesn't mean Chinese armies occupying Bangkok. That means a Thai prime minister, before he takes a major decision, checks with China to make sure that decision is acceptable, and if it's not, he doesn't do it. And I tried this out on a senior Thai diplomat, and he said, "We're already there. We're already doing that." The other thing that should be mentioned, and we'll get to the South China Sea, is it's part of the strategic implementation for China. The Chinese are determined, I believe, to establish international acceptance that the South China Sea, and we need a map here, and if I, on the little aircraft I had, if I could have brought a map, I would have, but that the South China Sea is in fact established as Chinese territory, not the Caribbean. This is Lake Michigan. This belongs to us. Okay, we'll come back to the South China Sea in a moment. All right, so that's my sense of how the Chinese sort of strategic perspective on this part of the world. Now, the interesting region, I'll say sort of the canary in the coal mine, the indicator, the place where the straws in the wind are blowing, that I think are revealing is in the South China Sea. And I should have said it sort of as part of a prologue that one of the things that makes all of this really interesting for somebody like me who's sort of interested in the complexity of international affairs is that there is a real debate, has been for some time, and is ongoing in this country amongst people who try to follow China, U.S.-China relations, China's strategic intent, all of that. There's a real debate as to what we're dealing with here. And there is a large body of opinion, and it's much of the Sinology community, academic and in the government, that tends to view China as basically a benign rising presence in East Asia. And there are a lot of the Southeast Asian leadership and academics who have taken the same view. Stop being so paranoid about China. China's behaved very well. You know, the Chinese say they're benign, and their actions tend to bear that out. We believe them. The contrary view is, and I'll associate myself with it, is that everything the Chinese have done is consistent with, has been, until very recently, has been consistent with an argument that we're benign. It is also consistent with a strategy that seeks to subordinate Southeast Asia, but does so carefully, thoughtfully, and in stages, and isn't precipitous before China is in a position to enforce its will. There's a wonderful phrase that Deng Xiaoping kept citing to his own population, and I'll use it with regard to the South China Sea, and it translates roughly, and it's a phrase that goes way back in Chinese history, back to the Warring States period, for those of you who know Chinese history. And it translates roughly as, bide your time, conceal your capabilities until you are ready to use them. Okay? Now, turning to the South China Sea, I will argue that that's exactly what China's been doing with regard to the South China Sea. When the Chinese came to power in 1949, they published maps, and I have one that I bought, 25 years ago, Chinese bookstore. You can buy the same map today, I'm sure. Just go in any place that handles Chinese publications and say, I want a map of China. And you get your map of China, and look where the maritime boundary of China is with regard to the South China Sea. And what you will see is a dotted line marking the boundary of China that encompasses the entire South China Sea. It goes very close to the coast of the Philippines, very close to the coast of Indonesia, very close to the coast of Vietnam, and then comes up and, of course, encompasses Hainan Island. And the essential argument I'm making to you is that line is not casual, it's not a figment of anybody's imagination, it's real. It's a line that the Chinese adopted that was already in place from the Kuomintang. It was originally published, at least sort of for wide dissemination, in 1936. I have a Chinese colleague who thinks she's found a precursor to it back to 1917, so I'm not sure about that. But in any case, it's a line that's been on the map since 1936. So the question in the sort of for outsiders has been, okay, they've got this line on the map. What does it really mean? And the sort of benign view of China has been, well, it's not really a serious international boundary. It's a kind of aspirational thing. Chinese don't really know and never really defined what it means. International lawyers get all wrapped around the axle trying to figure out how it relates to law of the sea or something else, and it all ends up being sort of lost in a fog of confusion. Part of my argument to you is the Chinese have fostered the fog of confusion. A part of it, and they fostered it since 1949, because when China comes in, they adopt the same line. Okay, what does it mean? Well, nobody's quite sure what it means. Part of the confusion derives from the fact that different voices in China say different things, and part of it is that they haven't sort of got the official line yet. So a journalist will say something, foreign ministry person will say something, a military guy will say something, and it doesn't line up. The Chinese have, in official capacities, made a variety of contradictory statements. You know, they'll rationalize the line one way and then another way, and those ways are not consistent with one another. They will rationalize it in ways that are not consistent with international law, law of the sea, but they will say they support law of the sea. So the outsider looking at all of this says, you know, do these people have any idea what they're talking about? I will argue much of it is deliberate. And it's back to Deng Xiaoping. Bide your time, conceal your capabilities. China views the South China Sea as exactly what that line says it is, i.e. is Chinese territory. But China does not have the maritime, military, naval, air capacity to enforce their writ. Meantime, Southeast Asian countries, Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, Philippines, have laid their own claims to parts of the South China Sea or parts of the myriad little islands and atolls and whatnot that comprise the South China Sea. So this was basically the situation up to the mid-1990s. In 1995, a Filipino aircraft, Philippines doesn't have an air force that's worth mentioning, but there was a Philippines aircraft flew over territory that the Philippines claims in the South China Sea and looked down on a little atoll called Mischief Reef. And lo and behold, there was something down there. Well, it turned out that the Chinese had built a concrete military revetments and anti-aircraft and all the rest of it on Mischief Reef. Filipinos didn't even know it was there. It was 120 nautical miles off the Philippine coast. It was well over 600 nautical miles from the nearest, from Hainan Island, the Chinese coast. Philippines protested to China. China said, oh, no, don't worry about it. It's just there to care for fishermen who may get lost and, you know, need resupply or something like that. Well, why are the anti-aircraft guns on the, you know? So we went through a sort of game. The Filipinos got the Southeast Asian countries, the 10 countries that make up the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, to present a unified protest of concern to China. That then caused the Chinese to start to pull in their horns a bit. And essentially, this was a case, in my view, where, you know, bide your time, conceal your capabilities. This was a case of where, we're now getting into a public arena here. People are starting to pay attention. We're not ready for that yet. And China then moved full bore in the wake of Mischief Reef into the charm offensive, the diplomatic outreach, the benign neighbor thing that I mentioned earlier. And that's basically where we were up until the beginning of last year. China, benign neighbor, Southeast Asia, basically accepting those assurances, conflicting claims in the South China Sea, but nobody's in a position to actually enforce their claims effectively. So everybody kind of, you know, leaves it aside. U.S. Navy steams through the area all the time, but we have no claims, so we pay no attention. The U.S. government hasn't issued a statement on the South China Sea since 1995. The whole thing is, if you are a Chinese strategist, bide your time, conceal your capabilities, is working very nicely. Okay, last minute. July last year, a meeting of something called the ASEAN Regional Forum in Hanoi, Vietnamese host, Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, first time the U.S. has attended a ministerial meeting of this organization. The 10 Southeast Asian countries are there, the Indians, the Japanese, everybody's there, including the Chinese. At the urging of the Vietnamese, who have their own conflicting claims with the Chinese, and are increasingly concerned about them. Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State of the United States, gives a statement. And she focuses on the South China Sea, which was not what the Chinese were expecting or wanted. But she focuses on the South China Sea. And she says two things that from a point of view of a diplomatic sort of practitioner were very ordinary. She says, you know, we've got an arena here with conflicting claims. We've got a whole bunch of different states that are claiming all or part of it. And in a situation like that, you ought to have a multilateral forum to sort of discuss it all so it doesn't get out of hand. That's point one. Point two was, you know, we've got a sea lane that works through, goes through the South China Sea. It's a traditional sea lane. It is, in fact, the world's busiest and most important sea lane by cargo of value that goes through it. And that sea lane, like all international traditional sea lanes, should be viewed as a maritime commons. It does not belong to anybody. It's open to everybody's use, military, commercial, civilian, whatever. That's all she said. Now, if the Chinese foreign minister had reacted by saying nothing or saying, okay, yeah, you know, multilateral diplomacy, you know, maritime commons, yeah, that's sort of garden variety stuff, nothing would have happened. There would have been no headlines. Nobody would have paid any attention to it except people like me and some of the Southeast Asian. But the Chinese foreign minister, and I will wind up on this. I'll do some stuff on the cutting room floor. The Chinese foreign minister did not react that way. He got red in the face. He's sort of hyperventilating, emotional, started shouting, had to leave the room to compose himself, come back, resume, and basically the harangue that he produced was, first of all, you Americans have no business getting into this. You have no business having anything to do with South China Sea, butt out. But the real emotion was directed at the Southeast Asians who had spoken in support, a number of them, in support of Secretary Clinton. And he basically, you know, you are ganging up on China. You are taking a hostile attitude towards China. We won't stand for it. And in the course of it, he looked at the foreign minister, who's also an ethnic Chinese from Singapore, and said, don't forget there are some countries that are big, like China, and there are some countries that are small. And the message was crystal clear. So I'll wind up on that and just say, I think what we're dealing with here is big time. I think it's serious. I think the South China Sea is crystallizing what we're up against in the case of China. And for the U.S., the strategic problem is acute. I'll quote, and I think I don't think you'll mind it. I was in a small session with Admiral Willard, the Pacific Commander of U.S. Forces. And at one point he said, look, he says, what I'm concerned about here is figuring out a way of coping with China's strategic ambition and a lot of paranoia towards the U.S. that goes with it without getting into a war. And he says, I want this to be the first time we have a major rising international power that doesn't produce a war. And it ain't going to be easy.
Of issues. The first two questions I got were essentially the same. I'm going to read them both. Why should the U.S. worry about China's displacement of us from the South China Sea? Or need it be a defeat for the United States to be excluded from the South China Sea?
Yeah. Fair question. I speak at the State Department's Foreign Service Institute sort of three or four times a year, and I often will pose that as a rhetorical question, basically. The way I would put it is, could the U.S. live with a Chinese dominance of the South China Sea and a Chinese strategic dominance of Southeast Asia that basically marginalizes U.S. military power? And my answer to that question is, yeah, we could live with that. Is it going to be the end of the republic? No, it's not. We'll continue to trade. We'll continue to have a presence. But it will be a recognition on our part that this part of the world is a true geopolitical sphere of influence under Chinese dominance. My problem is that I'm an American, And I think I understand the American psyche. Now, you may get a quarrel with that in the room. And I don't think we as Americans are prepared to accept that outcome. I don't think the United States, you know, I can imagine a conversation between a Chinese leader and an American leader where the American leader says, okay, we're gonna pull back here and we're gonna recognize your primacy. I just don't think an American leader will ever do that. And if we won't do that, then the problem gets real tough, because then you gotta figure out a way, if we don't do that, how do we maintain a position and not turn it into conflict?
Okay, the next question is sort of a follow-up. Where will China deploy its new aircraft carrier?
South China Sea. The Chinese have been talking about acquiring an aircraft carrier, and there have been sort of a couple of run-ups at this for a long time, but it looks like now they're actually going to get one. And when you think about it, it's sort of overdue and not surprising. If you're Asia's great rising great power and aspirant global superpower, great powers and superpowers have aircraft carriers. You know, it's part of the definition. So China's got to have an aircraft carrier if I'm a Chinese strategy. Whether it actually makes much military sense or not is another question. It's part of the uniform of a global superpower. So the Chinese will build a major submarine base on Hainan Island, right at the north end of the South China Sea. They will deploy out of there the aircraft carrier. I don't have any real doubt will basically deploy south through the South China Sea.
Okay, how about the Japanese? How are they responding to their China challenge?
With a lot of angst. For those who are students of Japan, it's an interesting thing that's been going on, again, sort of national psychology. Again, quick anecdote. Going back now 7-8 years, I was asked to come to Japan. It's one of these things where a think tank invites you to come, will pay your way, will set up appointments with you kind of around the Japanese government and so on, and then in return for that, you do talks like this and that sort of thing, and come for a week. So I did that, and I had a series of interviews around the military, foreign ministry, prime minister's office, people like that, and also journalists in Japan. And I've been beating this drum for a long time, and I was pushing the argument. I said, you know, China's ambitions in Southeast Asia are real. I think they should be taken seriously. I think this is what they amount to. I don't think Japan fares well under those ambitions. I would think Japan would be very concerned about this. The answer I was expecting to get back was, no, you don't understand. Japan's got a very good relationship with China. We understand the Chinese. Don't worry about it. You're another American who's just too, you know, gotten spun up about China, and, you know, just relax. I didn't hear that. What I heard was consistently, yes, you're right. We're very worried. We don't know what to do. And we hope you Americans will solve it for us. And there was a lot of hand-wringing going on with that. So, and that's sort of, you know, and it's just gotten worse if you're in Tokyo since. I mean, you know, you've had the Senkakus, you've had all these different issues that evidence that the Chinese-Japanese relationship is getting pretty rough, and the Chinese are going to play it pretty rough. And that for the Japanese is a sort of oh my God moment, because now Japan is no longer the world's second biggest economy. China has taken over that mantle. It's only a question of time until they surpass the U.S. economy in aggregate size. China is now, you know, larger economy than Japan, China rising military. The Japanese are, in my view, sort of petrified by the emergence of a major global power on their doorstep that doesn't like them very much. Thank you. Appreciate it.